You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the world is a complicated place, and we deal with uncertainty every day. We'll talk to the head of Stanford's design school about creative ways to embrace that uncertainty in solving our everyday problems. Now, some Republican lawmakers have proposed eliminating certain statewide elected positions and giving governors the power to appoint them instead. They want to amend the state constitution to eliminate elections for the state treasurer, secretary of state, and the state superintendent of schools, and make them appointed positions instead. If the idea is approved in the legislature in two consecutive sessions, it would then go to the voters in a statewide referendum. Wisconsin's governor is not part of the state constitutional amendment process. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? The Secretary of State and State Treasurer in Wisconsin have limited duties. Do you think they should be appointed rather than elected, in part because of that? Also, the State Superintendent of Schools. Do you like seeing that as a statewide elected position, or should it be an appointed cabinet official like a lot of other departments? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Shay Sortwell is a Republican from Two Rivers, representing Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. Along with State Senator Roger Roth of Appleton, Sortwell is proposing eliminating those elections for these positions in state government. Representative Sortwell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Before we dig into the specifics of these offices, big picture, what is your goal in changing from these elected positions to appointed positions?
You know, honestly, the biggest goal, the biggest reason why I think these are critically important is really for accountability. Now, you may ask yourself, how does that work out? How is that accountable if it's actually elected, not elected and appointed? How is that accountable? Well, the biggest thing is right now, a lot of people don't even necessarily know what these offices are and what they do, but they know who the governor is. And, you know, so if we can put these things underneath the governor, then, you know, when things go well, he should absolutely get the credit for those. And when things go poorly, then he should get the blame for that. Right now, they kind of fly under the radar and people don't even really know much about these offices.
Now, I want to tackle a few of them separately. We've got the Secretary of State and Treasurer, and they're notable for not having a lot to do. Changes made over the last decade or so have taken a lot of the responsibilities from those posts. Do you see this change from elected to appointed changing that in any way?
I think so. I think especially for, I think there's a number of things you could do with that. But here's the problem is when it's in a separate elected position, the governor, the legislature, we're not necessarily going to be terribly excited about transferring authority to them because it's taking away theoretically from one of these other branches, taking away from the governor, taking away from the legislature. And so especially like with the treasurer, you know, I think a lot of reason why people were hesitant to eliminate position before is naturally they thought, well, of course we need a treasurer. We need somebody to handle the money. However, I believe that if you actually look at the state of Wisconsin, the people who really handle the money is really the Department of Revenue. I mean, Secretary Barca is in charge of that. He's a fine holder of that position right now. But that really is a department that the treasurer ought to be running. So I think under my proposal, in fact, the treasurer would in fact be put in charge of the Department of Revenue under the governor.
Now, the big position here is the superintendent of public instruction, which does do a lot of stuff still. Why in particular would you want to say, no, voters, this is, I think, a more high profile position, too, than the other two. Why not let the voters directly hold that position accountable?
It is a higher profile one, but I would still challenge and say, if you went out to the everyday man and woman on the street and asked them who the superintendent of public instruction is in the state of Wisconsin, I will bet you that the vast majority of people couldn't tell you who that is. And once again, from the accountability standpoint, think about the fact that how the government in Wisconsin is administrated. By and large, it's done by the governor. He is the head of the executive branch of the administration. But then you also have this DPI superintendent. And so what you're dealing with is kind of this breaking up of the responsibility. And so I would actually challenge our current system right now and say, okay, so when things go poorly, which one of those really is to blame in this? And so obviously for quite a few years, Governor Evers was then superintendent of public instruction. and had responsibility over that department. And then we had Governor Walker at the same time. And you know, on the one hand, I've heard Republicans blame Governor Evers for poor results in education in the state of Wisconsin. And then I've heard Democrats turn right around and say it was Scott Walker's fault for destroying public education in the state of Wisconsin. This would really eliminate that defense from either side and say, okay, no, this is going to fall under the governor. If education goes well in the state, then great. The governor gets the credit for that. If the education system goes poorly in the state, he gets the blame for it. I mean, I think that's critically important that the public knows who is in charge.
Talking to State Assembly Representative Shay Sortwell, Republican from Two Rivers, talking about a proposed constitutional amendment that would take three statewide elected offices, treasurer, secretary of state, superintendent of public instruction, and turn them into appointees by the governor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Hello there. I got a couple of questions, and then I'm going to hang up and listen to the answers. Okay, number one, for your person that you're interviewing, what happened to a government that is supposed to be decided by the people? Not appointments, but by the people. And number two, if you take this away from the voter, what's in it for you and what's in it for us? Because all I'm hearing is, oh, more cronyism. Oh, I'm going to put my best friend into this position because he'll do what I say. So I'm going to hang up and you guys can hash it over. Thank you.
Pat, thanks for the call. And as I understand it, the idea of the Wisconsin Constitution as it exists is to separate those powers some, avoid what Pat is worried there about cronyism. Pat feels like this is taking something away from him as a voter, Representative Sortwell.
You know, I can appreciate that. And if these positions were ones that got a lot of attention and had a lot of engagement on these positions, then I think you would definitely have a greater point there. But a lot of these kind of fly under the radar. And secondly, the idea of appointment of certainly the DPI superintendent has very recent precedent. I mean, how many people are really aware that literally right before Jill Underly got elected this past, a couple months ago here, Governor Evers appointed Carolyn Stanford Taylor to be the DPI superintendent for more than 2 years. And I didn't hear a whole lot of outcry and demand from people saying we should hold a special election to elect Governor Evers' replacement when he went from DPI superintendent to governor. And so the precedent is there. We've accepted the fact that apparently it's okay in that situation, but it's not okay kind of all the time. So I think that, yes, there's always a chance for cronyism, et cetera, no matter what situation you put up there. But let's look at the treasurer. Generally speaking, the treasurer is kind of a coattails election. Whoever wins the governor's race, they end up winning the treasurer. That same party wins the treasurer's seat. Doug LaFalla in the state secretary of state position, that's a little bit different because he's been there for so long. He got such name recognition that I expect he'll probably be there until he decides to retire one way or another. But as soon as he retires, it's probably going to return to that same situation as it's going to probably return to the same thing as the treasurer, and whoever wins the governor's race is going to end up winning the races for those other two seats there. That's the way the elections roll out in the state of Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Shay Sortwell, State Assembly Representative from Two Rivers, talking about a plan to change and make a constitutional amendment to change the way three statewide jobs get selected from elections to appointments for secretary or superintendent of public instruction, the treasurer and secretary of state. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about the idea. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with State Assembly Representative Shay Sortwell, Republican from Two Rivers. He's telling us about his proposal to eliminate elections for a few positions in the state government, state treasurer, secretary of state, and superintendent of public instruction. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Tom on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think the idea that we need to dumb down government even more and actually abolish elected positions just because people aren't all that aware of them is an absolutely absurd idea. And it's a blatant power grab by Republicans in Wisconsin. I mean, not that many people can name the lieutenant governor. So given his logic, we should just get rid of that position, too. It is absolutely ridiculous. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call. Representative Sortwell.
Well, you know, once again, I can appreciate that argument, and I'm very sympathetic to that argument. But this is not a new idea, and it's not a radical idea. If you look at the great thing about America is we have 50 incubators of good ideas across the country. We have 50 states that can come up with good ideas, and we obviously have the federal government that, you know, does their own thing too, and it takes a lot of these ideas. If you look at these positions, treasurer, secretary of state, and, you know, whoever's in this instance, the DPI superintendent, they're called different things in different states. But roughly 40 states appoint in some way, shape, or form one, two, or three of these positions. Some of them actually are appointments by the legislature. I think it's New Hampshire it's Maine, I think. In Maine, the superintendent of instruction or whatever they call it in Maine is actually an appointment by the legislature. Now, if this was truly a power grab, that's what I would have proposed. I didn't propose that. What I proposed was that the governor, and who knows who the governor is going to be now or in the future, we're a purple state. Sometimes the Republicans are going to win. Sometimes the Democrats are going to win. And so you're going to have those that shift back and forth. So it's really not a power grab. It's simply acknowledging the idea that we really want one person that we can kind of hold accountable when things go south, or once again, give them credit when things go well.
Would there be a shift in the balance of power, though, if this is an appointed position, let's say DPI superintendent in particular, an appointed position subject to Senate confirmation? As we've seen, your colleagues in the Senate slow to approve some appointments, rejected one. This would give at least some more leverage to the state Senate over that top education job.
I suppose to an extent you could make the argument, but I would point to the record of the Senate. While they haven't appointed a whole lot, confirmed the appointments of the governor, they have left a number of them unconfirmed. Somebody who is an acting secretary has the same authority as an actual confirmed secretary. And if you look at, unless I missed one or two, it is my understanding there is only actually one person who's actually been voted down by the Senate.
Correct.
And so the governor has been able to have overwhelmingly his appointments in place, and that one person now happens to be a state senator, so I guess he got the last laugh on that. But nevertheless, is there then some additional oversight from the legislature? I suppose there is, and I don't see that as a bad thing. But once again, I don't think it's going to be a highly, highly partisan thing. If it was, we would have denied, you know, hundreds of appointments Governor Evers has already made, and we haven't done that. They denied one for, you know, reasons of their own. That's the Senate's decision. But one out of hundreds, that's not a radical power grab in my view.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Pat now in Mount Horeb. Pat, hi.
Hi. I'm not a fan. I think that it is a concentration of power. And, you know, to say that we could hold a governor accountable or blame them if something goes wrong because they're appointee, didn't do something right, it's sort of like driving using your rearview mirror. It's already done, and all we're doing is then punishing. I'd rather prevent and have a little bit better spread of balance of power and elect these positions. That's my thought. Thank you.
Pat, thanks for the call. So a better balance of power, she's saying, with electing the separate positions.
Well, I get what she's saying, but I would actually point to some of the issues we've had in over the last year and a half or so in the unemployment issue here in the state of Wisconsin, where the governor ended up firing his own secretary of, I think it was Workforce Development, if I remember the title correctly, Secretary Frostman there, because he felt that the secretary was not doing his job correctly. Well, if a DPI superintendent is doing things poorly, the governor can't ask for their resignation. Well, you know, they could ask for it, but they would be a fully elected position. And once again, a position that really kind of flies under the radar. I mean, the fact that it's even on a spring election is a little bit part of why it flies under the radar, but even still, a lot of people look at it and they just, you know, they don't think much about it one way or another. And so if you look at with the Department of Workforce Development secretary, with Secretary Frostman resigning, Governor Evers was able to hold that person accountable. And you can still blame, if you want, Governor Evers for how things went, were poorly administered. And to an extent, he certainly does deserve some of that, because he ultimately is the person in charge and the buck does stop with him. But he was also able to take some corrective action, which right now there really isn't that ability. And so there's a diffusion of responsibility. And it's like, okay, well, things are going poorly in certain areas. I mean, look at some of the problems in the Milwaukee schools. I mean, you can't deny that. Well, who's to blame for that? Is that the DPI superintendent? Is that Governor Evers? Was it Governor Evers while he was DPI superintendent? Was it Governor Walker? There's diffusion of responsibility. There's diffusion of blame and credit. And we need to clarify this for the people of Wisconsin.
Thanks for the call, Pat. In our last just minute or so, I want to ask about an absence here. There's one more statewide elected position, Attorney General. Why is that not on the list here?
You know, we did think about it. Obviously, from the federal government perspective, there's a precedent for having the Attorney General appointed, just like, you know, we have a Attorney General at the federal government level. As we thought about it, I kind of talked with a couple of people. We ended up deciding not to do it. And the main reason we decided not to do it, one, it's quite a bit higher profile, and a lot of more people do know about it. But two, I particularly like the fact that law enforcement, our highest level of law enforcement in the state, is elected. We elect our county sheriffs. They are the highest direct on the ground, boots on the ground, law enforcement county by county. And then obviously the chief law enforcement officer for the state. And so while some of those other ones were a lot more bureaucratic in their function, that one is a lot more executive and with a much more significant impact that I wanted to make sure there was still that attachment directly to the people. So we thought about it and we decided it probably wasn't appropriate for this idea.
We'll leave it there. Representative Sortwell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Shay Sortwell is a Republican from Two Rivers representing Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. He joins us today for a look at a proposed constitutional amendment in Wisconsin that would end elections for 3 statewide offices. More than 250 people with felony charges in Wisconsin have been pardoned by Governor Tony Evers over the past few years. But as Laurel White reports, the political history of pardons is complicated and the future of the pardon program is uncertain.
It was Jason Alston's first night in prison.
And the first thing, my cellmate at the time was like, "Man, what you doing here?" I'm like, "I got in trouble."
Alston had been convicted of having marijuana and cocaine with the intent to sell it, felony charges. But his cellmate said Alston, just based on first impressions, didn't seem like that kind of guy.
He's like, "Man, you don't look like you belong here." And I kind of took that like, yeah, you're right.
So Jason Alston made the decision on his first night in prison that he was going to turn his life around.
You know, because everybody has a choice to make the right decisions in life. And unfortunately, I didn't at the moment, but I knew then I wanted to start to.
So Alston served 19 months. Then he got his bachelor's degree and went to culinary school, became an executive chef, opened his own restaurant in Milwaukee. But he still had felon attached to his name, and that made it harder to do things like qualify for some programs during school and to get an apartment. Alston lived with those challenges for about 20 years until April 2nd, 2021. When Governor Tony Evers pardoned him.
I am one of those people that believe in redemption.
In an interview with PBS Wisconsin, Evers said pardons are one of the most meaningful things he does as governor.
All that is about corrections isn't about punishment. It's about getting people ready to reenter life.
Before Evers was elected, the pardon program in Wisconsin was dormant for 8 years. Former Governor Scott Walker halted the program after he took office in 2011. He stuck to his decision, even when thousands signed a petition asking him to pardon Stephen Avery, whose case was made famous in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. In a 2016 interview with WTMJ-TV, Walker acknowledged he had drawn a line in the sand on pardons.
Well, I have, and I think this is a good example where a pardon shouldn't be based on a TV show. A discussion about this should be based on evidence.
It should be based on evidence and the decisions of the courts, according to Walker. He told the Associated Press in 2013 that he had, quote, a hard time undermining the actions of a jury and of a court. But the difference between Evers and Walker on pardons shouldn't be considered a split between a Democratic governor and a Republican one. Mark Osler is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas and an expert on clemency. He says there typically isn't a partisan split over the value of pardons.
Not in the sense that blue states do more clemency than red states. If anything, it's the other way around.
Osler points out that in the last few years, states like Oklahoma and Alabama have granted clemency to more than 800 people a year. In Wisconsin, former Republican governors Tommy Thompson and Scott McCallum issued pardons, and so did former Democratic governor Jim Doyle. Between the three of them, more than 550 people were pardoned in Wisconsin over a 24-year period. Since taking office, no prominent Republicans have criticized Evers' more than 250 pardons over 2 years.
Both my parents were in the medical field, and they spent their lives trying to give people second chances physically, and I think this is one around giving people second chances spiritually.
Evers faces re-election in 2022, and his most high-profile Republican challenger so far is Walker's former lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clayfish. Clayfish's campaign didn't respond to requests for comment about whether she would follow in Walker's footsteps and suspend the pardon program again. And law professor Mark Osler says drawing that same line in the sand might drive away some prominent Republican donors, like the Koch brothers, who champion clemency. When Evers took office, there were hundreds of pardon requests waiting for him. Whether a backlog like that will start to pile up again in Wisconsin is an open question, at least until Election Day 2022. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, creativity can make life more fun and it can help us solve problems. We'll get inspiration from the author of the new book, Creative Act for Curious People. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It can feel like the world is a more uncertain place these days, and learning to work through that uncertainty can be hard. But our next guest says there's a secret tool, creativity. She says it's a crucial skill that helps us tackle all kinds of complicated problems in new ways. And we can learn to be more creative with a set of strategies from the world of design. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you think has made you a more creative person, a more creative problem solver? Or do you need help dealing with kind of ambiguous situations where there's not a clear right or wrong answer? Our guest might have some inspiration for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Stein Greenberg is the executive director of Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I remember back in school, a lot of problems that you do in your homework had, you knew they had one correct answer. And I found that in real life, a lot of times the problems aren't that simple. How important is it for us to get used to dealing with kind of ambiguity and uncertainty in our lives?
I mean, you really just put your finger on it, right? A lot of educational experiences we have are all based around that idea that there is one right answer. And, you know, the teacher has it on the answer key and or you can look in the back of the book. And then, you know, you get out of school and all of a sudden things are much more complex. And so one of those things that we try to emphasize when we're teaching design and we're teaching creativity is, you know, we want to have students practice on projects that are going to look a lot more like they do in the real world. And, you know, I think it's really fair to say that in the past 18 months, every single one of us has experienced, you know, really new challenges that have tested us and stretched us. And so having a method, having some confidence around your own creative skills, figuring out how can I apply them in this time of great uncertainty, I think some of those strategies can be really useful.
I know I think creativity sometimes is a thing that you either got it or you don't, or you have a fixed amount of creativity. You work to help educate people on being more creative. Is it possible to boost our creativity quotient?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's really one of those unfortunate myths in our society that only some people are creative. And it's interesting because a lot of people immediately when they meet me, they say, well, I'm not very creative because I can't draw. And there's this real tight association that people have with being good at a certain type of, visual output and creativity. Well, I honestly think that could not be further from the truth. So you can be extremely creative as an educator. You can be extremely creative as a nurse. You can be extremely creative as somebody who works in government. And so part of our mission at the D School is really to help expose more people to these basic strategies. We actually really, in this moment in history, we need more people exercising their creative abilities to solve the kinds of problems that we're all up against.
And you give a really good example to open your book. Actually, it's in comic strip form, creatively, that shows that creativity isn't just about, making cool music or visual art. You look at some students who are trying to help a hospital in India. Could you just talk a little bit about how their creative thinking helped overcome this medical challenge?
Yeah, so they were, we had a team of students. They came from all different parts of Stanford, a couple med students, a policy student, and an engineer. And so they came together around this challenge of really trying to help this hospital in southern India figure out how to act on their mission, which was around delivering very high quality but low cost care at a large scale. And the students went in thinking, given that mandate, we're really going to help them reduce some of the costs, or we're going to help the clinicians be more efficient with their time. But when they actually started getting to know the folks in the hospital and they went and did some interviews and observations, what they realized is there was a whole other opportunity that was kind of hiding in plain sight. And they noticed in particular that there were a lot of family members of the patients who were waiting around. They didn't have access to good information about what was happening, and they were really stressed out and anxious about what was going to happen when their family member returned home. So the students decided, okay, this is actually a really important need. Nobody else is addressing it yet. So let's see if we can try to alleviate this suffering of these family members. And what they wound up designing was an educational opportunity for people who, while they're spending time and waiting in the hospital, they're getting training on how do you take a pulse? How do you practice the important hygiene regimen for when your family member has just had surgery and they return home? And through that intervention, they've actually created an organization called Neura Health, which has trained over 1 million family members across South Asia to be really active participants in caring for their loved ones. And that has reduced hospital readmissions and reduced post-surgical complications. And the amazing thing is that is really not the framing of the problem that the students approach. It's not what they went in with. And so part of design work and part of creative work is that you remain open to possibility. And that is part of what allows you to really solve problems in unconventional ways. And that is exactly the kind of thinking that I think we need more of and that we strive to teach at the D School.
Talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg from Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has creative thinking helped you in your personal life or on the job? Are there things that helped you think, become a more creative problem solver? Do you have ways of teaching other people to solve problems creatively? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's dive into the heart of your book now, which is exercises. Some people can do alone, some in pairs, some in big groups, maybe even a whole class. What was your goal in creating these exercises or adapting, in many cases, things from your students and colleagues?
Yeah, so all of the exercises that are in the book are really pulled directly from our large teaching community. And these are real assignments that we teach at Stanford, but they're very flexible. So as you said, you can do them in lots of different contexts. And what I'm hoping to do is to get everybody to just try something that's a little bit out of their comfort zone. So in some cases, you know, folks have that block around like, oh, I'm not sure how to express myself visually. I've got all these ideas, but I just don't know how to draw. I don't know how to build my ideas into a format where other people can give me feedback about them. So there are assignments that are about visualization. There are assignments that are about what we call prototyping, which is kind of building rough models very early in your process. So somebody could actually say, oh, I get what you're saying. I get what your idea is. Let me give you some feedback. On the other hand, there are folks who, you know, the skill that they're looking to develop is about how do I receive feedback differently? Or how do I reflect on and notice my own creative abilities and how they're changing over time and how I'm learning? And so there's a whole section of assignments that are really around reflection and self-awareness and understanding and kind of assessing your own creativity and your own creative abilities. And I really believe, you know, it's like no one person has exactly the same set of needs as a learner, as a creative person. No creative project looks exactly the same. So in this book, I really want readers to be able to navigate for themselves and figure out what are the particular skills you're most interested in acquiring today. And there's something in there, I think, for everybody.
Let's check out a couple that maybe people could try at home. One that I liked, and this is one you can do solo, I believe, a seeing exercise. Talk us through this one, please.
Yeah, this is a great exercise that was adapted by a group that really specializes in what are called visual thinking strategies. And it's amazing what we don't realize we're not noticing all around us on a daily basis. And so this exercise has you take a photograph. You can take, there's one in the book you can use for practice, or you can take one from a newspaper and really just kind of slow down your thought process. So you look at the photograph and you ask, what am I seeing here? And then you ask, what makes me say that? What is actually the data or the thing that I'm observing that makes me interpret the thing that is happening here in this picture? And then you ask yourself that again and again. And you spend maybe about 15 minutes with one photo. And you start to notice detail that you just realize, wow, in those first 5 minutes, you didn't even notice that whole section, or you didn't notice that dynamic or the shadows or some kind of relationship. And what you begin to realize is that because our brains are constantly filtering the information that we're seeing all around us, there are opportunities that are lying in plain sight. And just like those students in India, when they had the opportunity to really observe the situation and notice in a bit of a different way, they spotted an opportunity that was being unaddressed. And that's often where a lot of opportunity for creative problem solving or for innovation comes from, is noticing that thing that no one else has actually identified as a problem or an opportunity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Winter. Dave, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I have continued my education by listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been listening now for about 25 years, and I'm serious. It opens my eyes to a lot of different things, and it makes me think about getting a second opinion about some things that I recognize being talked about. I'll play back on your tapes. I just want to thank you for that great community service that you're providing, and keep on keeping on.
Dave, thank you so much for sharing that, and I hope Wisconsin Public Radio does this well, but that reminds me of one of your exercises, expert assumptions. Dave was talking about going back and examining things and getting other opinions. One of your assignments, this one takes a little longer, involves doing something kind of like that.
Yeah, that's right. There's a wonderful practice. You know, most people have heard of brainstorming, right? Mm-hmm. But there's another important practice, which is called assumption storming. And that is really useful when you want to make sure that you're kind of like challenging yourself to find that second opinion, as Dave was saying, or you're thinking about a problem or an opportunity through multiple lenses. And assumption storming simply has you break down the problem or the thing that you're working on and list all of the assumptions that you can think about. So in the book, I use the example of, you know, let's say you work in your public library and you're trying to redesign what the entryway might be. What should the experience be for people who are coming in? What should it feel like? What should it look like? What activities might happen there? And to begin, you just might list all the assumptions that you have about how a library, quote, has to function, right? It has to be quiet. It should be accessible to everyone. It tends to attract such and such a kind of person in the community. It does or doesn't have computer access. And once you list all of those assumptions, you might find that some of them are facts, some of them are more opinions, and some of them are kind of guesses. And you can just, in that structured way, recognize, wow, if I challenge some of those things that are opinions or guesses, well, I'm going to have a whole lot more creative space to play in. But if you don't name those as assumptions, you might sort of unconsciously assume that that whole part of the situation is fixed, right? That there's no changes or improvements possible. And so surfacing those early in a process is actually really valuable for creating more open space within your design work.
Thanks again for that call, Dave. We're talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg, head of Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People: How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways, jam-packed with exercises you can use, you and groups of others as well, if you want, to help boost your creative problem solving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that's inspired creativity, whether for fun, or for serious purposes? Do you find creative solutions to difficult problems? Do they come easily for you, or is it hard work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how to do a better job dealing with uncertainty using creative strategies from the world of design. Sarah Stein-Greenberg is with us. Her new book is Creative Acts for Curious People: How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Still time for your call with your questions about how to be more creative, or maybe your experiences, something that's inspired you, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Sarah, you've got a couple exercises that would work well with pairs of people. I usually hate icebreakers at meetings because I'm surly and standoffish, but these I would do. I want to check out a couple of them. One called First Date. I laughed about it. First Date, Worst Date.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites. And, you know, it's interesting that you say you hate icebreakers. I'm also not a big fan of icebreakers. We use a lot of what we consider kind of warm-up activities, which, yeah, you know, there's a similarity with ice breaking, but I always try to use one that is related to the behavior, the kind of creative action that I want someone to take later on in the session. So I'll tell you what I mean by that. So First Date, Worst Date is a really fun kind of combination of storytelling and building with physical materials. So you sit with a partner and each of you build a representation using Legos of your first worst date. And it's kind of amazing because, like, everybody has a story about this. Maybe it's a romantic date, maybe it's like a professional date or some other kind of date, but everybody has a funny or a embarrassing or a touching kind of story about this. And the thing that's the challenge is that's kind of an abstract prompt. Like, are you gonna express a feeling through Legos? Are you gonna kind of tell a linear narrative about something that happened? And I've seen people kind of create like a cliff, you know, out of Legos, because that was what the date felt like falling off a cliff, right? Or you know, sort of something that like started poorly but ended well, and you can kind of see how they've created that in a physical form. And it's a really interesting skill to develop, because as I was saying earlier, when you learn how to express your kind of abstract, fuzzy, new ideas about the kind of solution you might be thinking about, and you put those into a physical object, all of a sudden someone else can say, oh, I understand what you're saying. Like, let me respond to that. Let me give you some feedback. Oh, let me build on that. Let me give you some new ideas. So that process of taking something out of your brain and putting it into the real physical world, even if that's not the way it's going to live on as a product or a service, that is one of those core skills in design that I think everybody can use a little bit of.
Let's go back to our callers now. William is with us in Wakefield, Michigan. William, hi.
Oh, hello. I just want to say thank you so much for what you do, and wish everybody out there a positive day. I just found out through this pandemic or epidemic, whatever you might want to categorize it as, that people become more lenient on the internet. And I just want to give, I guess, a shout out to the YouTube that's been remarkable, because you can tailor, you know, your highlights for what excites you, and basically see true, you know, live stories about people's, you know, ups and downs and how they overcome things, and kind of get
yourself before you even know it.
You're breaking up, William, but point taken. William has found a lot of creativity on the internet and sounds like he's inspired, especially by young people using the internet creatively to express themselves. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think of what I'm hearing in that example is, you know, kind of some empathy that you can develop, right? You see someone's story, you really identify with it, or maybe they are living a different life from you, but you kind of get that sense of the ups and downs. And, you know, empathy is something we talk a lot about in design work, because you're really usually designing something for other people, right? That's part of what, you know, separates design from art in a way. And so if you're trying to come up with a creative solution that meets the needs of someone else, you got to understand them. You got to understand what motivates them and what they need and how their life might be better if you can design a solution for them. And so I love that example of this sort of unconventional source of input and inspiration to really understand and identify with the experiences that other people are having.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg about her new book, Creative Act for Curious People. Back to your calls now with Dan by Rice Lake. Dan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking about this and joining the show. I taught visual media in universities for 38 years, and the key for most of the students to make a change in how they were thinking about, for example, their photographs, was to get them to define the photograph by way of adjectives rather than nouns. It was that simple. And all of a sudden they start seeing much more in the photograph if it is something other than a dog or any other descriptor of that sort. So just changing the basic language you use to describe what you're doing from nouns to adjectives.
Dan, thanks for that call. And I think, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, you've got an exercise in your book that looks at a picture and ask you to describe what the person in the picture is doing, first by nouns, then by verbs. So very similar exercise to what Dan did.
Yeah, I'm so struck by the similarities. And, you know, first of all, what an amazing lesson from, you know, clearly a master educator that we just heard. I think that, you know, part of what's going on there is just the power of framing, right? And in that case, like shifting from nouns to adjectives creates this whole new way of seeing, right? That's really interesting. And the exercise that you're describing, Rob, we often assume or interpret so much of what's going on and what people might need. So in this particular one, you look at a picture and you try to come up with like, what do you think the person in the picture actually needs? And almost every time, all of the first things that people come up with are nouns. And that is kind of like the solution already. But if you can change your language to verbs, so in the case of this picture, there's a young girl who's standing on a ladder and reaching up in a bookcase. So the first thing people usually say is like, oh, she needs a book, or she needs learning, or she needs knowledge, or she needs a parent to come help her. But actually, if you say, oh, she needs to reach, she needs to learn, she needs some help, right? There, that actually creates, well, there are lots of different ways that she could learn. There's lots of different ways that she could get help. And whereas if you just say like, oh, she needs a ladder, she needs a chair, she needs a longer arm, that's kind of limiting the solution space. So shifting that vocabulary towards something that's much more open-ended, that's one of those techniques that you can use to create much more opportunity for yourself when you're setting out in a creative project.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last few moments, Sarah, can you leave us with a bit of inspiration to try some creativity tonight?
You know, I think it is all about trying. And one of our key philosophies is like, especially as an adult, it's all about learning by doing. So if you happen to grab this book, or maybe you're trying to learn something new and you're using YouTube, right? Like actually just learn how to change the mirror, the side mirror on my car. Like just stretch yourself to just try to learn something new. That actually like fills us up so much. And you can do that in very, very small ways. But the key is not just to think about something, but actually to try it out. That changes your disposition towards the thing that you're trying. It builds your confidence. And whether that's a creative act or some other thing that you're learning, that would be my provocation, my last word on this.
Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Stein-Greenberg, Executive Director of Stanford University's Design School. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Creative Act for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, heroin and opioid drugs get a lot of attention, but meth is the big drug problem in many Wisconsin communities. Find out how Chippewa County is looking to turn things around. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, our Constitution protects our liberty, but what does that really mean? We talk about why you still have to stop at stop signs, obey traffic lights, and generally protect the safety of others with a Wisconsin political scientist. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.